just want to welcome and thank Rabbi Reese from all the way from Chicago, the Nahal of the Chicago Rabbinical Council based in, previously the Nahal of the RCA based in New York, and previously Yale law graduate and a lawyer, but Baruch Hashem in the past few years he's dedicated his life to Klal Yisrael, and we thank you for coming again to talk about halacha issues relating to women and feminism, and thank you.
My pleasure. So the Gemara Ne'archin on Daf Yud Zayin has a machlokas tanaim between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim on the pasuk Zedor Dor Shav Makshei Panecha Yaakov Sela, that this is an account of all of the different generations and the leaders of the generations. So Chana Mar Dor Lepia Parnas V'Chana Mar Parnas Lepia Dor. One opinion in Tanayim says that the generation goes according to its leaders, and the other opinion says, no, the Parnas, each leader, goes according to the generation. So in a Sefer by Yoel Schwartz, he says, really, both opinions are correct, that the leaders of each generation have to take into account the trends of the generation. But those in each generation have to ultimately be deferential to their own rabbinic leadership. There has to be a symbiotic relationship when it comes to recognizing the needs and the realities of each door and the issues that confront every single generation. So one of the watershed issues for our generation and for our times is what you may refer to as feminism. Now, when the movement of feminism first arose, certainly in this country, in the United States, several decades ago, many viewed it as something which was negative, which was a force for resistance against the established traditional order of the roles that have always broken down men and women. The men would go out in public and they would go into the workplace. The women stayed home and reared the children as a general proposition. And suddenly there was a major change and there was a major upheaval in terms of women being much more involved in receiving higher education and going into the professions and even assuming leadership roles. And this, certainly from a sociological standpoint, was a source of consternation. And from a religious standpoint, looking at it halakhically, there was a concern since there are roles that define men and women in Judaism as well. Would this be a movement in which those proponents of feminism would seek to change the halakhic order of Judaism, which is something that could potentially be very dangerous? On the other hand, some view the movement as having positive elements as well, to the extent that there were stereotypes regarding roles that may have been viewed as off-limits to women, certain negative stereotypes regarding the capabilities and capacities of women, that there was now a realization that women were capable of accomplishing more, and even a stirring and yearning on the part of women to be able to contribute more to society. And in the context of Judaism, that could also have positive ramifications in terms of women feeling more empowered in terms of having a greater fulfillment of their own Torah learning, in terms of having a greater fulfillment of depth and an appreciation of their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and even a desire to participate more fully in the raising of future generations of Torah personalities. So fundamentally, at this point in time, after we have wrestled with the movement and its positive points and negative points for a substantial period of time, I think that when we refer, for purposes of this shiur, to the term feminism. I noticed that Rabbi Orlian gave it that title for this iteration of the shir.
More excited to come.
Okay. I think that at this point, the term feminism, at least for purposes of this shir, is a neutral word that simply serves as a reflection of changing roles and expectations, and provokes for us an analysis of how to deal with this reality in a constructive and in a positive fashion, in a way which is consonant with Torah values and principles. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote about this in a tshuva regarding the Nashim She'ananot. He refers to the women. The term She'ananot is taken from Yeshayahu, Perek Lamed Beis, and has the connotation of women who are self-confident, or women who are carefree. That's kind of the meaning of She'ananot. And this is in the Igros Moshe, Chelek Dalet Simen Mem Tes. And he cites the pasuk, Kosomar LeBeis Yaakov V'Sageid LeBnei Yisrael, that we know that Beis Yaakov is a reference, not at that point in time to the school system, but was a reference to women. And Levnei Yisrael, you were supposed to speak nicely, Kosomar, Lashon Amira, Raka, and Besagei Levnei Yisrael is a reference to men, Dvarim HaKashim Gegidin, to be a little tougher when it comes to conveying Torah to men, that there was an address by HaKadosh Baruch Hu's instruction to both the men and the women, and the continuation of the Psukim state, that both to the men and the women was this imperative and instruction that they were to be a goy kadosh, and therefore concludes Rav Moshe that the notion of kedushas Yisrael, of the holiness of every single Jewish person, applies equally to men and to women. The fact that women are exempt from certain mitzvos, the mitzvos esei shezman grama, the fact that women are not counted for a minyan, that there are certain limitations with respect to their roles, is not at all a reflection of a lesser kedusha with respect to women. I think the way Rabbi Tversky put it in one essay is that there's no discrimination against any particular gender. There's a discrimination between the genders, that there are different roles that the Torah assigns to men and to women. Rav Soloveitchik said the same idea with respect to the idea of the exemption of women from mitzvot esei shezman grama, where they start off having an equal kedusha with men, but the women are simply exempted from what otherwise would have been assumed to be a parallel obligation. This is in contrast, for example, to an Eved K'naini, said the Rav, who are also required to perform mitzvot esei shezman grama, but that's not, I'm sorry, they're required to perform mitzvot esei shelo esman grama, but for them, that is a special obligation that they have, rather than them starting off being obligated in everything and then exempt from something. So the notion of women being viewed somehow on a lower plane of holiness of Kedusha is antithetical to Jewish belief. There's certainly an equal view of Kedusha when it comes to men and when it comes to women. Now, Rav Moshe writes there that, therefore, it is certainly legitimate if women, he refers to these Nashim She'ananot, that if the women want to perform mitzvahs from which they are otherwise exempt, the mitzvahs esei shehazman grama, so says Rav Moshe that they are certainly entitled to do so, b'toris eina mitzuva v'yoseh, that we don't find any restriction, for the most part, in terms of women volunteering to do mitzvahs from which they are otherwise exempt. We know the classical examples of shofar and of lulav and of sukkah. However, he says that it has to be l'shem shemayim, that the whole point is to enhance the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to enhance the Kedusha that the women have anyway. So if it's done with an appreciation for the entire system of Torah, so that's perfectly legitimate. In fact, there's a tshuva by Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Rabbi Akiva Eiger writes, it's really the first tshuva in his whole collection. It's a footnote in the back, an endnote that he adds afterwards, where he writes that with respect to the mitzvahs of Sukkah and Lulav and Shofar in particular, women have actually accepted these mitzvahs upon themselves as a chova, that they treat it as if it is an obligation, even though technically speaking it's not an obligation. But Moshe goes even further to say that although it's described in Shulchan Aruch as a yura, if it was an act of arrogance or presumptiveness, if a woman, presumptuousness, if a woman should wear a tzitzis or talis or something like that, he says, if we could get around any sort of beged isha problems that you might think of, that it would be the same beged that a man wears, and you design a separate talis garment that was particularly designed for women, and it was being worn l'shem shamayim for purposes of sincerity. So that also is negotiable. That also could potentially be arranged. But says Rav Moshe that there are certain things that are non-negotiable. Certain halachos where we've already paskin, like in Shulchan Aruch, we paskin with respect to tefillin. The women are not allowed to wear tefillin, even if they would want to wear tefillin, based on the requirement that there be a guf naki. So therefore, even men only wear tefillin to the degree in which it's absolutely mandatory to do so, but we take off the tefillin as soon as we finish tefillas shacharis. And the same idea, since women are exempt, they're not allowed to volunteer wearing tefillin, says Rav Moshe. And number two, he says that with respect to the other mitzvahs that can be volunteered, if it's being done because the women feel that the Torah has somehow deprived them or discriminated against them in some way, so then to volunteer with that mindset, says Rav Moshe, is completely unacceptable. So he establishes the basic parameters. There has to be an acceptance of the framework of Torah and appreciation for the framework, that even without a performance of all of these other mitzvahs, women nonetheless assume and enjoy the same kedusha equality as men. There was actually a brouhaha about the tefillin issue several years ago that you may recall. In a certain school, they decided that they would allow a woman, if she wanted, I think it was one of the students wanted to wear tefillin, and they said that it would be okay. So at that time, both Rav Schechter and Rabbi Tversky wrote responses to this determination, saying that this was incorrect, that once we have a clear non-negotiable psak, that something can't be volunteered, so you can't be a greater chacham than the chachmei HaTorah, than the transmitters of Torah Shebaal Peh from generation to generation. Rav Schechter brought the example of the Parah Aduma, that we see sometimes the chachamim, in order to show that even a particular leniency should not be disparaged. If it was promulgated by Chazal, like that a Tful Yom, Kohen Tful Yom, could perform the ritual of Parah Aduma, that the Chachamim, the Prushim, would deliberately be Metame, the Kohen, who would be Osek in the Parah Aduma, so he could be a Tful Yom at that time, in order to demonstrate that the avoda of the Parah Aduma was kosher with a Kohen who is a Tful Yom. And so too, whether it's the Kula or the Chumma, there has to be a reverence for the teachings and for the rulings of Chazal. And here we have a halakha mefereshes that women don't wear tefillin. Tversky noted as well that the halakhic system, if one really wants to have this conversation within the halakhic system, it's not about picking and choosing. There's a larger system over here, and one cannot presume to paskin, to change tradition cavalierly, because that would be what the Gemara describes as shote vegas ruach, somebody who's megis libo the hora, that to somebody feels that they know better than the Shulchan Aruch. Look, everyone can make a mistake, but it's important to point out when the mistake is made so that it can be rectified. So one has to understand the ground rules. The halakhic way needs to guide the rabbinic will, if you will. That is the way in which we operate, that there is a halakhic way, and that is what we have to work within in terms of navigating these issues, that we can't have a conversation about feminism, we can't have a conversation about making changes in norms and practices in order to confront modern-day realities without starting off with a tremendous Yiras Shamayim and kavanos that are purely l'shem Shamayim and also emunas chachamim. Yes?
Sorry, I didn't understand that fully. Your point there, Shepard,
made the point that there were tzidukim who were critical of the notion that here we have this incredibly holy ceremony, and how can they paskin that a tful yom is allowed to perform the ceremony? So they felt that they don't accept that halacha. So the chachamim go out of their way to be metame a kohen, so he could become a tful yom, go to the mikvah, be a tful yom before performing the ceremony, in order to make it clear that bein l'kula, bein l'chumah, one has to have respects for the conclusions of the Chachamim when it comes to deciphering the laws of the Torah. Now, let's pick one area where... Yes, go ahead.
Just in terms of the Torah issue, is the same psak applied to Sparta? Or is there any...
I believe so.
Does even though it's the Ramo, who explicitly brings that...
I think that this is a psak Mekubal. I think so. Okay, now, in the realm of Talmud Torah, the Mishnah in Sota, Daf Chof, and Aleph records a machlokes between Ben Azai and Rabbi Eliezer about whether it is appropriate or permissible to teach one's daughters Torah or not. Ben Azai says yes, and Rabbi Eliezer says no, but the halakha is like Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer's principle is Komalamid Bita Torah Kiilu Lamda Tiflus. Anybody who teaches their daughter Torah, it's like as if they've taught them promiscuity. So that's a pretty strong statement, and one that one can understand in today's modern age would ruffle some feathers. So we have to work with the fact that the halakha says this, that it says that there's a limitation with respect to teaching women Torah. But what if a woman has a tremendous thirst for Torah? What if a woman is learning all kinds of other academic subjects, a woman is well-versed in the world, and she feels that if she's not going to be able to really immerse herself in Torah, it's not going to be meaningful to her, it's not going to speak to her, this will affect her Shmiras HaMitzvos, it will affect her Yiras Shamayim, is there any wiggle room? So here as well, one has to turn to Chazal. If you see the way in which this halacha is paskin in Yoredeya, the Minresh Memvav, Sivvav, so the Shulchan Aruch builds into the halacha based on the understanding of the Rishonim of this principle, that there are built-in mitigating factors and caveats. First of all, the Shulchan Aruch says, Rov Nashim, Ein Daitan Mechunos Lislame. The majority of women, the assumption is that the majority of women were not suited to a high-level Torah study in terms of what they needed to prepare for Torah life and a Torah existence. Already the word rov creeps in, which means it's not an absolute principle. The Chazal allowed for the possibility that there would be some wiggle room. It's not, it's only rov nashim. Secondly, the Rambam writes that this is there's a distinction between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebichtav, at least on a B'dievid level, this was considered to be acceptable to teach Torah to women. Number three, it says that one is not supposed to actively engage in the same Torah instruction towards their daughters as towards their sons. After all, it says you have the main emphasis is on teaching Torah to sons, but that doesn't necessarily mean that if a woman wants to learn on her own, that she has a thirst that is self-generated, that she can't learn Torah. And finally, the Ramah points out what should be relatively obvious, but that a woman, of course, is obligated to learn Torah with respect to the laws that she needs to know. She's obligated in all of the mitzvos lo saseh, she's obligated in all of the mitzvos esei, shelo esman grama. And she's obligated certainly to have a fear of heaven and a desire to raise a Jewish family, B'dusha, B'tara, and she has to be taught all of the principles and all of the teachings that are necessary in order to be prepared to fulfill that role. So the preacher of Yeshua Falk, in his commentary to the Torah, so he addressed really these first two issues, which he said that when we say that you're not supposed to teach a woman Torah, so he says that that means that you don't actively teach your daughter, but if your daughter or daughters indicate that they have a love and a thirst for Torah, so says the preacher, at least with respect to the notion of lo yilamed and rov nashim, he says such a woman who shows that she's interested in learning Torah, so she's yotze min harov. She clearly demonstrates that she's not part of this presumptive majority that's not interested in learning Torah, and of course it would be perfectly appropriate and proper for her to learn Torah. In fact, the Torah Tamima, in his commentary to I think the Sefer Devarim, so he has a very fascinating quotation from a Sefer, an earlier Sefer, really a few hundred years earlier, called Mayan Ganim. This is the Torah Tamima on Devarim, Perek Yud Aleph, and it's a note Mem Ches. It says, "Amnam Anoshim Ashenada Liban Osan Lekavel Amalacham Lechas Hashem Mitzayim Bitzchirasam B'Tov B'Mashu Tov." There were women who themselves are self-motivated to learn Torah. And Heina Talena Be'Har Hashem Tishkona B'Mkom Kadsho K'Neshem Ofeseina. So they should rise to the highest plateaus, the mountain of Hashem. They should reside in a divinely holy place because these are wonder women. You've heard of a movie, right? They have Wonder Woman. So these are the true wonder women. These are the women who are motivated to learn Torah, right? And the chachamim of the generation should not discourage them. Rather, they should encourage them, they should adorn them, they should honor them, and they should strengthen their hands. A woman wants to come closer to a Kaddish Baruch Hu by learning Torah. So we view that as a fantastic thing. That could be a very, very good thing. She's self-motivated. And in fact, many of the programs that have been developed nowadays for women to learn Torah take women who are steeped in Yiras Shemayim and help them be able to grow in terms of their knowledge and their appreciation of the Torah. The Chafetz Chaim built upon this other principle of the Ramah. The Ramah had said a woman's obligated to learn that which she's obligated to know. The Chafetz Chaim wrote in his commentary to Maseches Sot and his Likutei Halachos, he said that it used to be that the women would pick up what they needed to know in Torah just growing up in their parents' homes. They would see what their mother did and they would be able to mimic it and they would know what to do. But he said now the women are going away. They're going to university. They're going to trade schools. They're learning professions, they're learning academic studies, and they're not picking up anymore what they need to know just being in the home. And he said the homes are not necessarily such where everything gets transmitted so seamlessly. And therefore he recommended that it was time to develop a school system. This is how the Beis Yaakov movement emerged, in which women would be taught in a more formal and a more sustained fashion. Chafetz Chaim spoke about learning Torah Shebektav, learning Sifrei Musar, things of that variety. Rav Soloveitchik built upon that later on when in the 1950s Rav Soloveitchik was asked by Rabbi Rosenfeld, who at that point was in charge of the Board of Jewish Education, I believe, was asked by Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld whether it was appropriate even to introduce Torah Shebaal Peh study, going even a step beyond the Torah Shebichtav, which the Rambam said that is certainly on a B'dievid level acceptable to teach the women, but even on a Torah Shebaal Peh level, the Rav was asked whether it's appropriate to teach women, and Rav Soloveitchik said that he thought that it was a good idea. Rav Soloveitchik not only thought it was a good idea, but he was actually very, very emphatic about it. And the Rav said that he thought, he said, as to your question with regard to a curriculum in a co-educational school, leave aside the merits of co-education or under what circumstances that was something that could be countenanced, I expressed my opinion to you long ago that it would be a very regrettable oversight on our part if we were to arrange separate Hebrew courses for girls. Not only is the teaching of Torah Shebaal Peh to girls permissible, but it is nowadays an absolute imperative. This policy of discrimination between the sexes as the subject matter method of instruction, which is still advocated by certain groups within our Orthodox community, has contributed greatly to the deterioration and downfall of traditional Judaism. Boys and girls alike should be introduced into the inner halls of Torah Shebaal Peh. Very strong statement. If anybody made that statement nowadays, they'd probably be put into favor. But the Rav was a gadol hador. The Rav can make a statement of that sort. What was the Rav really getting at? So various family members, you look at the essays of Aaron Lichtenstein, of Tversky, others explaining the Rav's approach with respect to this issue, explain fundamentally that from the Rav's perspective, this was really an extension of the principle of the Ramah. The Ramah had said you have to teach a woman whatever is necessary for her to know the dinim that she needs to perform. The Rav felt that you needed to teach a woman even Torah Shebaal Peh so she would be steeped in Yiras Shemayim if she was going to become very sophisticated in other areas of study and academia and would not have the same depth and breadth of knowledge when it came to Torah study. So then there would be a deficiency in terms of the Yiras Shemayim that she would be able to acquire. And since part and parcel of one's ability to perform mitzvah is even a prerequisite, prerequisite of learning and practicing Torah is having the necessary Yiras Shemayim. Therefore, to the degree that conveying the depth of Torah Shebaal Peh was necessary in order for women to have that appreciation, this became part and parcel of what the Ramah had enunciated as what is required to be conveyed to women in order for them to practice their mitzvos properly. Now, of course, this extension will depend upon circumstances. It will depend upon communities. In certain communities, there might be a different form of instruction or a more modified form of instruction that would be more successful at achieving this result. It doesn't have the same intrinsic and objective chiyuv as Talmud Torah has with respect to men. It's more utilitarian in nature. What is necessary in order to achieve this end result of Yiras Shemayim and commitment to Shmiras HaMitzvos and continuing the tradition and transmitting the traditions of Torah to future generations. So therefore, one needs to understand the halakhic context of the Rav statement in order to be able to apply it properly, in order to be able to appreciate it properly. But let's say now, you have these women, these Neshei Mofes, as the Torah Tamima describes them, who have learned Torah, have acquired tremendous Torah knowledge and wisdom, and now they want to be able to do something with that knowledge. Well, on the most fundamental and basic plane, what to do with that knowledge is to practice mitzvos and transmit those Torah values and mitzvos to future generations. But there are also other roles that could be played conceivably with the possession of that knowledge. A person who has tremendous Torah knowledge, if the Gemara says about Rabbi Eliezer, that more than an eagle is wrote to you know, Linok, more than a calf wants to nurse from its mother, a para rotsa lahonik, the mother, the cow, has an even greater yearning and thirst to be able to provide milk to its children. So the same idea is applicable to those with great possession of Torah. There's a tremendous thirst to be able to convey that Torah. But on the other hand, one also has to be circumspect about what are the appropriate roles, what is the appropriate framework to enable that sharing of Torah, to enable the women who have acquired so much Torah wisdom to be able to share it beyond the family unit with the greater community. But you have to take these types of strivings seriously. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein described this as the tension that you need to navigate. He was always very good at drawing up dialectical tensions. It's the tension that needs to be navigated between Dvar Hashem Zu Halacha, the notion of our strong fidelity and steadfastness to Halacha on the one hand, and the idea that it's appropriate, lasos nachas ruach nenoshim, on the other hand, that you have to figure out what are the needs of the women of the community. This was a notion that the Gemara had as well, that there were certain things that were done, lasos nachas ruach nenoshim. Interestingly enough, the case where this is mentioned, the Gemara in Chagiga Daf Tesvav is mentioned in the context of women who wanted to do smicha, not receive smicha, perform smicha on the korbanos, and they would bring a korban, so the halacha is the men do smicha, but the women don't have an obligation to do smicha. So Rabbi Yossi said, even though women don't have an obligation to do smicha, nonetheless, they would allow the women to do an imitation smicha. Not real smicha, it shouldn't be avoda bikochim, an imitation smicha. Why would he allow an imitation smicha, resting of the hands on the animal of the korban, to be performed? Lasos nachas ruach l'noshim. Sometimes it has to be lasos nachas ruach l'noshim. Is not just a simple concession, but it is bearing in mind what is necessary in order to preserve the morale of the greater community, in order to preserve Torah observance and to generate Torah passion, which is a major objective when one is determining the future direction of the Jewish community, so that we can be successful moving forward. Now, when thinking about any type of position and navigating this tension that was articulated by Rav Lichtenstein, there are three global concerns, and then there are what we would call the technical rules that need to be observed. The three global concerns that I would describe are Srara, Tznius, and Mesora. That there is a rule that is articulated by the Rambam that women are not supposed to hold positions of Sarara. So that has to be reckoned with. What does it mean? Sarara means presumably leadership on some level. And what does it mean that women can't assume a position of leadership, particularly when you live in a world in which women are partners in law firms, women are CEOs? And it's also important to bear in mind that, speaking as a husband, women are very much in charge of their own domestic homes. As the Akeres HaBayis, as any Jewish husband knows, the Rashi, Al-Chumash, describes when Yiska is first introduced, and Rashi tells us that Yiska is Usara, that Yiska is the name of Sari Menu, she was Socha B'Ruach HaKodesh, so he says that it's also a Lashon of Nesichos, it's a Lashon of leadership, a lashon of like a princess, somebody who occupies an exalted position. And he says, just like Sara, when the Yisker's name became Sara later on, is a lashon Sarara. Sara is a lashon Sarara. So we have some sort of a notion of the Sarara of Sara. There must be some sort of a Sarara position that is appropriate for women. We have to carve that out and figure out what are the gedarim of Sarara. Then there is the idea of tznius, that every single person is supposed to live a life of tznius, tznei lechus, right? Tznei lokecha, you're supposed to walk modestly in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and ein lecha yafe min tznius, that's why the luchos rishonos, the Gemara says, they were destroyed because they were given with great pomp and ceremony and fanfare, so therefore they did not have a good fate. But the luchos shnios that were given much more modestly, without all of the bells and the whistles, so that had a permanent kiyum. So we see from here that one is always supposed to conduct themselves with shnios. It's never really desirable that anybody should occupy a leadership position. However, there's a concession, since we do need leadership positions. So the men are obligated to assume it, and they're not supposed to do it with great excitement. Even when Moshe Rabbeinu was chosen by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we know that he was extremely hesitant to accept the position of the leader of Klal Yisrael. We know that the Gemara in Horio speaks about how Rabban Gamliel wanted to convey special sorority. He wanted to give leadership positions to two of the Tanaim, two young Tamidim. I think Rabbi Elazar Chasma and Rabbi Yeshua ben Gugoda, the source in front of me. Here we go. Rabbi Elazar Chasma, Rabbi Yochanan ben Gugoda. And he wanted to give them, he saw that they were in need of an income. He wanted to give them a position of leadership in the community, and they were hesitant to accept it. And he said to them, what do you think? You think that I'm giving you a position of glory? I'm giving you a position of servitude. We recognize that even what we refer to as Sarara, as serving in a leadership position in Klal Yisrael, essentially ends up being one of servitude, as any administrator here at Yeshiva can tell you, that there is a servitude that's built in, even to having to be in a position of leadership. It's not one that is viewed as desirable per se. So to the degree in which that has to be done, that's something which is generally reserved for the men. It's generally reserved for the gevurim. But when it comes to women, we have a special requirement of kol kavuda bas melech penima. When it comes to women, the dignity of a bas melech, of a princess, is internal, is inside of the palace, and that is the way in which l'chatchila we would want to educate the women in our community to maintain their elevated status of their kedusha through a life of tznius, just like we really are all supposed to live that life of tznius. But it is especially pertinent to women. Sometimes it can seem like an albatross. Sometimes having that mandate, that extra mandate of tznius, can seem like a burden. The Gemara, I think, to some degree acknowledges this. The Gemara in Eirvin Daf Kuf says that there were 10 klolos that were given to Chava after she ate from the Eitz Hadas, and one of the klolos was that she would be chavusha beveis asurim, that she wouldn't be able to go out and circulate as much in the public sphere. And Rashi on that Gemara says, yeah, what does it mean chavusha beveis asurim? Yeah, just like it says, kol kavuda bas melech penima. So you wouldn't think of kol kavuda bas melech penima as a klola. Certainly it's not a klola, it's a bracha, but it can seem like a klola. Sometimes there could be a thirst to be able to do more, to assume more positions of sorority. Nonetheless, the Torah imposes limitations. So it's very important to understand the nature of those limitations. And finally, there's the notion of mesorah, that we have a shalshelus hakabbalah. We have certain rules and regulations and traditions about the way things have always been done. It's not only a question of the black letter law that appears in the Shulchan Aruch, it's also the spirit of the halacha that has been guided and shepherded by the chachamim of every single door, right? Every single door, lefi parnas, apanas, lefi ador, that we have a certain mesorah, a certain tradition as to what has been done and what's considered to be acceptable and how we balance these different requirements and these different guidelines. In addition to all of that, there are the technical exclusions. Just like there are technical laws that might be difficult for anybody to observe. The famous story of Rav Soloveitchik, who counseled a couple that was very much in love, said they couldn't get married because the man was a Kohen and the woman was a Gioris, and the halacha is that no matter how much compassion and sensitivity you have, and how much the couple might be in love, you can't change the system to allow a Kohen to marry a Gioris. Turns out he's not really a Kohen. Okay, he's not really a Kohen, but if he's really a Kohen, and she's really a Gioris, and you can't fix the problem, so to speak. Well, you have to determine it's not really a problem, because that's what the Torah says. And the Rav was sat down with his couple, and he cried because he felt very, very bad for that. But he said he has to submit his will to the will of the Almighty. This is very much, as we mentioned, a part and parcel of the analysis. So there are certain exclusions that are derived in the Gemara, that women don't count for a minyan. Women are excluded from Eidus. V'amdu shnei ha'noshim lifnei Hashem, ha'noshim v'lo noshim. A woman is also excluded from serving as a dayan. The Gemara quotes a Gzeira Sokosuf, sport in the Yerushalmi as well. So even if one can explore the parameters and some of the areas of flexibility when it comes to the global concerns of a sorora and snios and mesora, there will be certain non-negotiable items as well. It's very interesting. This past year, the OU appointed a commission made up of a number of YU Rosh Yeshiva to examine some of the questions regarding women's roles, particularly leadership roles, Bizman Hazeh. And the OU commission ended their analysis, a very nuanced and very carefully calibrated analysis. Obviously, Rabbanim doing their best to confront with sensitivity and at the same time a fidelity towards halacha, these various questions, understanding the needs and understanding the issues that are involved. And they ended with a statement that it is through the modicum, or the medium, of halacha and Torah ethos that we find liberty and exaltation in surrendering ourselves to the divine will. So I think here they were really being honest and forthright that it's not only a limitation to surrender oneself to the divine will, but there is a liberty and an exaltation to it. There is a recognition that we are participating in a process in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu has entrusted us with His holy Torah, And therefore, we have to very carefully calibrate our approach towards these issues with an understanding of the limitations that are imposed upon us by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. But we know that by staying within the framework of those limitations, that we can be assured that we will be able to more successfully arrive at the right result, because we believe in the truth and we believe in the divine nature of the Torah. It's like David HaMelech said, "Ani avdecha min amasecha bitachta l'moseirai." I am your servant. You have freed me from my chains. So how could you be both? How could he be a servant and he's been freed from his chains? Because being a servant to a Kodesh Baruch Hu is being freed from the chains of the uncertainties and the vagaries of this world, and knowing that one is subscribing to a system which is all good. This is the idea of Charusa Alukos, Altikri Charusa Elcherus. So, with respect to Sarara, some of the Gedarim appear to be a little bit uncertain. The Rambam, when discussing the idea of Sarara, so the Rambam says that the restriction of a woman from Sarara is not only with respect to being a Malka, but not only with respect to being a queen, that we derive very easily from the pasuk Som Tasim Alecha Melech, Melech Velo Malka. But says the Rambam, Mechen Kom Mesima Shebisoa Mimanim Ve'em Ali'ish. Not only with respect to the Malkus, but with respect to any kind of position of authority, there has to be only men and not women. Now, the question is this really muskum? Does everybody agree to this? This drasha, the Rambam, doesn't appear in traditional midrashim. You'll find the Midrash Tanoim, seek the Zatarti. You'll find it in a few of the later midrashim, but you won't find it in earlier midrashim. And the Rav Moshe even suggests, Rav Moshe Feinstein, that this might be Svaras Asmo. Maybe the Rambam himself came up with this medrash. Very bold statement on the part of Rav Moshe. What did Rav Moshe deal with? He dealt with a situation of a woman who was a mashkichah. She was together with her husband. Her husband had been a mashkiach for many years. The husband passed away. And then the wife wanted to take over. She had learned the trade through her husband. She wanted to be able to take over being the mashkiach of these various kashrus enterprises because it would afford her a poor amana with parnasa. Rav Moshe said, well, we have a problem over here. The problem is that, according to Rav Moshe anyway, being a mashkichah is sarora. That's considered to be leadership. As I mentioned before, leadership is not always so glorious, per se. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a position of kavod. It means it's a position of responsibility. Rav Moshe defines sarora as whenever you have the ability to tell the Balei Habayis, to tell the Balabatim what to do. You tell the Balabatim, sorry, you have to throw out this pot, you have to kasha this pot, you can't serve this food. That's directing the Balabatim what to do. That's what a Mashkiach is obligated to do. So he says it's really a position of sarora, and according to the Rambam, it's off limits. But says Rav Moshe, not everyone agrees with the Rambam. He points to the Sefer Achinuch. For Sefer Achinuch, when he talks about the laws of a Melech, so he says, well, a Melech has to be a man, Melech v'lo Malka. Then he goes on and he says that the positions of a Melech, the position of Melech gets passed on in Yerusha, that it's inherited by the children, by the sons of the Melech. And then he says that not only the position of Melech is inherited by Yerusha, but all positions of authority go by Yerusha, all positions of leadership and authority go by Yerusha. So it says Rav Moshe, when it talks about what goes by Yerusha, the Chinuch mentions not only being Melech, but all the other positions as well. But when the Chinuch talks about the exclusion of a woman from a position of authority, he only mentions that she's excluded from being Malka, that she can't be queen, she can't be the ruler of the entire nation. But the Chinuch did not extend that to all these other positions. So therefore, says Rav Moshe, that when he brings Raya's, the Rashi Tosas, the Rashba, others, also hold like the Sefer Achinuch that only a position of Malka is off limits to a woman, and therefore Rav Moshe says that there is some flexibility in a dire situation where you're not compromising the principles of the Torah, you're not promoting a woman in order to violate norms of tznius or anything like that. It's a position of being a mashkicha, a technical issue of Sarara, that one can potentially look beyond the Rambam. It says Rav Moshe, if you have the ability to fix the situation without violating the Rambam, so then you have an obligation to do so. And he says that here you can actually fix the situation. How can you fix the situation? He says that you can appoint the Rav of the community to be officially in charge of the Hashkakos, that the woman would be appointing, would be reporting to the rav of the community, even though she would essentially be doing all of the work, but because of the fact that there would be a rav who would be formally and officially in charge, so that way the Rambam's prohibition against a woman assuming sarava in any realm whatsoever would be respected, and at the same time, we would be able to devise a solution and resolution for this woman to be able to take on the position. He says that this lashon is very important. He says, "Rabbeinu lemaisa yesh lahakmek shita saramim deime kiven de plukta beravusa." He says, "Look, since it is a machlokis, we showed him." The Rambam says that any position of sarava is off limits to a woman, therefore we have to respect it. And he says, "Mukhrochen lasos ke'etza," and therefore we have to follow this etza. It's not only a good idea, but it's obligatory upon us to follow this etza of appointing the rav to be ceremonially in charge. Sharei memela leka sarach lismoch al mekilim, because this way we don't have to rely upon those who are lenient. So that's how Rav Moshe came out. Yes.
Couldn't you apply that logic to a woman being an assistant rabbi or even being a full-time rabbi if you had some form of an organization on top of the rabbi?
We'll get to that. This is with respect to Svara. If you have a person, if a woman is reporting, okay, if she's reporting to a rabbinic authority in terms of her duties and her responsibilities, according to Rav Moshe, this is a mitigating consideration in order to potentially neutralize or to diminish the Svara considerations. It doesn't mean that there aren't other considerations. So, for example, Rav Soloveitchik felt that the limitation or exclusion of a woman from Sarara was not only with respect to positions of authority, but with respect to any position in which somebody is appointed to a public post, any position of minoy. Rav Soloveitchik explained in this fashion, you'll find this explanation in the Sefer on Hilchos Shechita of the Rav, published by our own Rav Eliyakim Konigsberg, when he wrote up the Rav's notes on Yoredeya, where the Rav explained that when the Me'ikar Adin, a woman could be a shochet. But the Ramah says, nowadays women don't shecht. We haven't seen women shecht. And there's a whole critique of the Ramah, Lo Me'inu Ein Oraya, that just because we haven't seen the women shecht, that's not a proof that women are not allowed to shecht. And the Shach says, no, when it comes to Minhagim, then Lo Me'inu actually can constitute a raya. So what's going on over here? Rav Soloveitchik explained that it used to be that everybody would shecht in their own backyard. The shechita was not something where you appointed somebody as the town shochet. Everybody could do shechita. A man could do shechita, a woman could do shechita too. However, explained the Rav that when times changed and the position of shochet became a community appointment, became like a big deal, you're appointing the town shochet. You look at certain small towns in American history, and who the Rav was not nearly as important as who the shochet was. The shochet was the person who made the town. This is how everybody could eat food. This is what really counted. You're not the sermon, but the kiddush you go to afterwards. You have to be able to enjoy the flesh. So once it became a community-appointed position, explains the Rav, so then it became like Sarara. Not Sarara in the sense of authority. A shochet might have been required to report to the Rav of the town in terms of the pecking order, but in terms of just the fact that it was a community appointment, it was a public position. So what would be the nature of why it should be that there's this additional extension of minoy being off limits to a woman? We don't find, for example, with respect to a ger, a convert, who also is prohibited and precluded from serving in a position of sarara, according to the Gemara, right? So it has to be somebody, lo sukala seis alecha ish nachari, that you can't place somebody upon you who is not born Jewish, the way that this is darshan in the Gemara, and yet we don't find that a ger is excluded even through a minim from serving as a shochet. So the Rav said, because a ger is only excluded from positions of authority, but when it comes to positions of minoy, that's not off limits to a ger. What's the svara? What's the rationale to distinguish? Where is there a gzeiros or kosuv that seems to distinguish between the nature of svara for a man and for a woman? So Rav Schechter suggested in an essay that he published in Chakira magazine, Baruch Shekivanti, to the same idea, that it's because the exclusion of a woman is primarily based, at least the way the Rav understood it, upon considerations of tznius, meaning that it's simply not considered to be tsanua for a woman to be appointed to a public position. And therefore, based on principles of kol kabuda bas melech penima, this now becomes a halakhic imperative. We find that. We find that the Gemara darshins, the pasuk kol kabuda bas melech penima, to teach us halakhic principles, like the Gemara in Yevamos, and daf ayin zayin, that says that based on that idea of kol kabuda bas melech penima, that's how the halakha was finally resolved when it says, Lo yavo amoni b'kal Hashem, Lo yavo amoni b'mo'abi b'kal Hashem, that somebody from the nation of Ammon and Moab, whatever the order, is not allowed to enter into the community of Hashem. So the Chachamim Darshan, this was a whole big machlokis between David HaMelech, Doei Gadomi, you know, how do you properly darshan this? Because the yichus of David HaMelech depended on it. Because his great-grandmother, Ruth, came from the Moabim. She was a Moabite convert. So therefore, if she would not have been allowed to enter B'kal Hashem, David would not have been legitimate. He wouldn't have been able to be Melech. But it was Paskin, no, Moabi v'lo Moabis, Amoni v'lo Ma'amonis. Why is that? So the Gemara explains, because the Torah gives us the reason why is it that the Ammonim and Moabim were not allowed to intermarry, to convert and intermarry after conversion with the Jewish people, with those who are born Jewish. So the reason is because Lokin Nostem Melechem Uvamayim. When we left Egypt, they did not come out and provide hospitality in terms of giving us food and drink. So the Gemara says it's Derech Ha'ish Lekadim, that it is the proper etiquette. Of a man to go out and to go out into the street and provide food and water, but it's not considered to be the proper etiquette of women, even insofar as the women going out to give food and water to other women. But since it's in the public sphere, since the Torah says, since the pasuk says kol kavuda bas melech penima, this is not considered to be within the realm of modest behavior. Therefore, the women cannot be penalized for not going out. And for that reason, since they're not subject to the penalty, it was mutter for Rusa Moaviah to marry Boaz after she converted to Judaism, and that's why David HaMelech is considered legitimate, and that becomes a halakha for all of eternity. So we find that we do establish halakhic principles. Even Malchus based David is established based on this principle of kol kavuda bas melech penima, this is a principle also that helps to define what the gedarim are with respect to permitted or prohibited sarara when it comes to women. What do we do then with this idea of the sarara shel sarara that I mentioned before? You could say, okay, it's nice, it's a medrash, we don't pass an halakha on it. No, but I do think that there's a place for this idea sarara shel sarara, meaning that if there is a position where there is an authority, but it is one that preserves the gedarim of tznius, and particularly to address Ramosha's point that there's also rabbinic supervision, but it's a position which is appointed for the purpose of tznius, or to preserve ideals of tznius, and that's something that potentially could be countenanced. That's why some say that, for example, if you had a woman serving as a principal of a girls' school, so maybe even if you held that being a principal under normal circumstances would be an issue of sarara, maybe this wouldn't enter into the framework of sarara because it preserves the boundaries of tznius. This is a tshuva by Rav Aryeh Grossness in the Leib Aryeh, where he says the opposite. He says, no, any kind of position of authority, even a woman being a principal of a girls' school, would be a problem of sarara, but it's not a problem for other reasons, because he holds that being a principal is not a sarara, because you're not telling, like Rav Moshe, you're not telling the Balabatim what to do, you're just instructing the students and as to what to do, and you're arranging the curriculum. And you're hiring faculty and things of that sort is not necessarily telling the Balabatim what to do. There are disagreements about how to be Magdir Sarara. Some say, no, of course being a principal of a school is Sarara. It's big time Sarara. However, you could say, yeah, that it is Sarara, but nonetheless, since it preserves its tznius, so therefore it would be more palatable for that reason, particularly if you had some communal rabbinic figure who was technically in charge of the entire educational system, so that you address Ramosha's concern as well. So this is a way of confronting the various issues and grappling with them in a way that makes sense. Like, for example, nobody ever really questioned the notion that a woman goes to a mikvah, you'll have a mikvah lady who's helping her figure out whether she has a chatzitza or not. Why is that? You'll say, oh, it's sarara. No, first of all, the mikvah lady is subject to the rules and regulations that are promulgated by the community rabbanim. But secondly, we're not worried about sarara so much because this is a position that preserves tznius. Not only is it not antithetical to tznius, but it preserves tznius. we should know that there was a whole machlokas at the time in which the position of kala teachers was formalized in this country. If you take a look at Encyclopedia HaMa'or, very interesting volume. I happened to daven in a small shul in Chicago during the week called Congregation Based Yeshiva. Sometimes I look at the books on the shelves. Every single small old shul, you find very interesting books on the bookshelves. So I found Encyclopedia HaMa'or, which is a compilation of various articles, sometimes English translations of articles that appeared in this Torah journal HaMa'or, and with the editor of this journal HaMa'or, who also happens, I believe, to be the same person who was critical of Rav Moshe when Rav Moshe wrote his tshuva, is saying that sometimes there could be some wiggle room, like with a woman mashkicha, when it comes to Sarara. So this person wrote a letter to Rav Moshe saying, you're opening up the floodgates, now they're going to start appointing women to be presidents of shuls, and who knows, you know, what else is going to happen next, and they'll make them the prime minister of Israel. This is before Golda Meir was appointed. And Rav Moshe said, I'm not worried about Israel because they don't ask me their shilos anyway. And with respect to the shuls, obviously every single shul will consult with their rabbinic authorities. They'll look at the Rambam, and they'll figure out how to apply the Rambam with respect to the Rambam's principle not to appoint women to positions of a sorority. So he wasn't worried. He said the one is obligated to speak the truth. You have to look into the Torah, not to worry about your sociological fears. You have to look at what the halakha says and figure out how to apply the halakha responsibly. So this person also wrote an essay in which they were decrying this new position that had been created in America called kala teachers, that now with the kala teachers, who knows what the kala teachers are going to tell the women, instead of consulting with their mothers and their mothers-in-law to tell them the proper way that they should comport themselves, now the kala teachers are going to come up with all kinds of kumras and who knows what else, they're going to have a totally warped view of how they're supposed to conduct themselves. So every single position comes with machlokas, and over time, there's a consensus that forms as to whether the various parameters of halakha, the various parameters of hashkafa have been appropriately preserved, and whether this is something which is constructive and positive for the community or not. So kala teachers is something that we viewed as positive. It helps to preserve tznius. When a woman is taught that she's instructed, she has another woman who's sitting down with her. It's true, maybe she's appointed, she passes a course, and she gets appointed as a kala teacher. You might say it's some sort of a minoy, but it's one which preserves tznius. It's one which I would argue comes into this framework of what is the positive and the affirmative sarara shel sarara described by Rashi that would be appropriate for women to assume. Now, of course, this has led in our contemporary times to a whole machlokas about, well, are there other positions that perhaps could be fashioned that preserve the notion of tznius, and not only preserve it, but further and advance the notions of tznius, where you could take these well-educated women in the Torah and help them advise other women when it comes to taras and mishpacha in general, so that the women who feel uncomfortable going to men all the time and having certain types of sensitive and delicate conversations with men, maybe they wouldn't have altogether, will be more likely to respect and to observe taras and mishpacha if there are women serving in this capacity. And this was part of the incentive of the creation of the Yoatzot Halakha program. Now, the truth of the matter is that you could probably have women serving in the same type of capacity who are alerted women without necessarily conferring a title, an official title upon them. You could have the local Rebbetzin. The Rav is educated, the Rebbetzins are very educated, you know, as well. Rebbetzins taking a course and learning appropriate halakos and then being able to sit down and talk to the women, even have the conversations with the women, and then when there's an important shaila that needs to be addressed, they can have a conversation with their husband and then get back to the women. You can have them really doing something very, very similar. But the feeling was that having a separate track altogether, even if it's not necessarily the Rebbetzin, is something that could be a constructive force in certain communities. In some communities, the Rebbetzin is not necessarily Misugelet to serve in this capacity. So maybe you could have somebody else brought in. That's one of the questions. What about just having kala teachers who are taught to advise and to instruct the kalas, not only before they get married, but even after they get married? That's another possibility. In certain communities, you have very, very well-trained kala teachers. They're not called Yoatzot Halakha. They're called kala teachers, but they're kala teachers who are also available for consultation even after a woman gets married. And that at least doesn't seem to create some new structure or framework where there are concerns that some have that with all of the other titles and positions that are being advanced that have more of a question mark when it comes to the nature of their srora, with the nature of the sneers of the position, that maybe it's best not to carve out the new titles and new positions, but perhaps to enhance and embellish old existing positions. The answer really is that with respect to every single community, there's going to be probably a different answer to this question, but it all has to be done in consultation with the Gedolim. It has to be done in consultation with the Chachmei and Mesora to figure out what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. From Rav Soloveitchik's position, whenever you have a title that's conferred, an appointment, oh, we're appointing in our shul, a woman's going to serve as the X and X. So according to the Rav, any position of Minoy raises concerns automatically, because the Rav held that by definition, if there's an official communal Minoy, so that raises Sarava concerns. So that itself is something that has to be part of the reckoning. Others would say, well, in this context, if I have a woman who's serving as a Yuetzet Halacha, so this is a Sarava Shel Sara type of position where they're helping to further the observance of Taras of Mishpacha in the family, in the family and in the community. And therefore, if it's done in a way in which it's clear that she's subservient to the local Rav, and she's not paskening on her own and doing things on her own, that maybe in this context, especially if the leaders of a particular community think that it will facilitate Torah observance in the community, maybe it could be a good thing. If you look at the OU resolution, or the OU statement that was promulgated by the panel of Rosh Yeshiva last year, they just recently had an update with respect to their statement as well regarding implementation of the statement. So you'll see that they wrestled regarding this issue of Yoesed Halacha. They said, look, there are arguments in favor, there are arguments against, and therefore we admit that we're not 100% sure, we're not all-knowing, and that every single community will have to make a careful determination in accordance with its rabbinic leaders. And like the position of Kala teacher from several decades ago, time will tell whether this particular position is constructive or not within the community as a whole, within certain communities and not other communities. But everything has to be done very, very carefully. Everything has to be done with a tremendous sense of caution, tremendous sense of respect for tradition, and also a care and concern for the needs of the women and others in the community who could really benefit from these types of positions in appropriate cases in terms of advancing their own Yiddishkeit. You know, there was a question that somebody posed to me at one point that according to those who are in favor of the Yoetzet Halakha program, so it is appropriate. Is it appropriate for a woman to paskin on a mara? Let's say that a woman has been trained as a Yoetzet Halakha. So what are the parameters? Is it just that she has the sensitive conversations, that she's a conduit between the women who have the shilos and concerns and the rav who ultimately serves as the posek? Or once she learns about different colors and different rules, that maybe she could even paskin on amara? So this itself is a source of controversy now within the community. An isha posekit, can a woman paskin a shiloh? Can a woman paskin a shiloh? And this leads a little bit to the whole discussion about can a woman serve as a rabbi? Oh, that was a very, very hot button issue, right? Can a woman serve as a rabbi? And what does it mean to be a rabbi nowadays? I remember when I was serving as the menahel of the Beis Din of America. So once I used to get calls from reporters. Now that I serve as our Beis Din in Chicago, I still get calls from reporters from time to time. So you have to be careful how you navigate your conversations with reporters. I would be willing and I would be open to having some type of a conversation, figuring that better that the voice of Torah Judaism should be expressed in some fashion, hopefully in a positive way, whenever there would be questions that arose. But this was one time I just pashut didn't have anything to say. They called up and they said there was a rabbi, apparently in southern New Jersey, who was performing intermarriages. Everybody thought, people who were going to this rabbi to have their intermarriages performed, thought that this was a legitimate rabbi, and they thought that therefore their marriages were blessed from heaven because they had a rabbi who was performing the marriages. It was some sort of a reform rabbi, or somebody presented themselves, obviously not as an Orthodox rabbi. And then it turned out that the ordination that they claimed to have was bogus. They didn't really have rabbinic ordination from the institution that they claimed that they had it from, and therefore it turned out the person was not a rabbi after all. So they called me up and they said, so what now is going to be the status of all of these weddings? Now that it turns out that the rabbi is not legitimate. So I didn't even know where to begin answering that question. I did not want to get into a whole question of who's a rabbi, who's not a rabbi. The question that we'd be discussing halakhically today is, can a woman be a reformed rabbi? So we'd be having a very different conversation. We have the discussion, can a woman be a rabbi? It means something. It means, in terms of the rabbinic tradition, in terms of the rabbinic title that's been passed down from generations to generations, that began on some basic level with Moshe Rabbeinu conferring smicha to Yehoshua. When we speak about rabbi, that's what we mean by rabbi. If rabbi is not going to have any kind of a meaningful title, it's going to be a piece of paper from some institution that's going to allow intermarriages, so obviously the whole conversation doesn't really get off the ground. When we speak about rabbi, when we have a conversation, have a community about rabbi, it's because smicha means something. It still has some type of a holy and sacred significance. That's why it means something in our institution, in our yeshiva. You get smicha from the yeshiva, it means something. It's a continuation of some sort of a fundamental misover that you are receiving. So that's the conversation that we're having. Part of that conversation is whether a woman can paskin. Is a woman allowed to paskin? So this whole discussion centers a little bit around a Tosfos in a few places in Shas. Tosfos asks the woman about Dvorah being a shofetis. Sefer Shoftim, there's a Dvorah, she's a woman, she's a shofetis. So how could she be a shofetis when we know that a woman cannot serve as a dayan? That's the rule. A woman can't serve as a dayan. You know, she can't be an aid, therefore she can't be a dayan, so there shouldn't be anything to discuss. So Tosfos gives a number of different answers. One answer Tosfos gives is, oh, maybe it's possible you could not be an aid, but you can be a dayan. We reject that answer. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, the Psak, black letter law, nobody disputes it in any way. Isha psua lagu. A woman's not allowed to be a dayan. She can't be a dayan. A woman is excluded from the parsha of dayanus, gzeres hakosuf. So Tosfos gives other answers. It could be that everybody was mekabel her. It could be that it was alpi hashchina. And then one of the answers that Tosfos gives is, maybe she didn't pass. He might some lamedis. Lahem, she taught the other dayanim, she taught the chachamim, lahem, she yadunu, that she taught them dinim, she yadunu. That she taught the rabbanim, she was such a wise woman who knew so much Torah, she was a shofetis, she had the Ruach HaKodesh, she had Nevi'ah, she was able to convey Torah to the dayanim, she yadunu. Haysam lamedis lahem dinim, she yadunu, as Tosfos says in Yevamos. So according to this, it sounds like, on the one hand, she was paskening for them. On the other hand, she was sort of facilitating their paskening, right? Some 11 Islam dinim, she was teaching them dinim, sheyadunu, so that they would be able to pasken. Now, sheyadunu, of course, means that they'd be able to serve as a dayanim, she couldn't serve as a dayan. So on some level, maybe if there wouldn't be the dayanus issue, or wouldn't be in the form of a din Torah, so maybe Tosfos is conveying that in fact it would be legitimate for a woman who's a very knowledgeable woman, afita that knows Torah, that she would be able to paskin. This is what the Piskei Tshuva in Choshen Mishpat quotes the Chidah as holding this way. The Chidah was of the opinion that a wise woman is allowed to paskin. Now he quotes others, the Shari Tshuva says, maybe she's only allowed to be kovea what the metzias is, to figure out what the circumstances are, to tell the dayanim so that they can say, based on her investigation of the facts, Isha Chachamah investigated the facts, so now we have the facts that we can paskin. But the Chidah says, no, she can paskin. The Sefer Chinuch basically says the same thing, because the Sefer Chinuch says that if you're shikar, you're not allowed to paskin, right? It's Purim, and you're already past the point of Ad Lo Yada. If somebody comes to you and asks you a shiloh, you're not allowed to paskin. So says the Sefer Chinuch, this is not only for a man who's shikar, but even a Isha Shikar is not allowed to paskin. If she's a wise woman, and normally she would be able to paskin if she's drunk, so she's not allowed to paskin. So that everybody agrees to is that if the woman is drunk, she can't paskin. But if she's a chachama, and she's not drunk, Sefer Chinuch indicates that it would be legitimate for her to paskin. So this is a further proof that such a thing would be legitimate. So it's not off limits. If you have a woman is very, very knowledgeable, she could paskin. Even if you held that Sarora and Minoy would be off limits, you have a wise Rebbetzin who's paskining for her household, or paskining for other women within her inner circle, things that she's very knowledgeable about. It would seem that such a thing, if it didn't come with an official appointment, such a thing would be potentially acceptable. It comes with the appointment, so then you have to deal with the svara issues. You have to figure out what are the issues that you're dealing with. What if it comes with smicha? What if it comes with actual rabbinic ordination? So here, this is another area where Rav Shechter writes this, that it really seems pashut to me as well, that the notion of a woman serving as a rabbi is really a non-starter. Why is it a non-starter? If you look at the Rambam's description of what it means to serve as a rabbi, so the Rambam says, "V'keit said he asmicha l'doros." What is the notion of smicha? Lo sheyismichu yidein arosh hazaken lo shekorin lo rebbe. Not that you put your hands right like the smicha that we were talking about last week, nachas ruach kadoshim, right? They do smicha on the kabbonos. No, it's that you call somebody rebbe, you call somebody rabbi, you call somebody by a name that sounds like rabbi, rebbe, rabbi, rabba, right? The omim lo harei at somok. And you say you are hereby somok, you hereby are ordained. The yesh l'cha, and what does it mean to be ordained? The yesh l'cha rishus, l'adun afilu dinei knosos, you could serve as a dayan. That was the idea. Ordination always went along with a qualification to serve as a dayan. And even nowadays, when our smicha is not technically a continuation of the original smicha of Moshe Rabbeinu, is interrupted. The Gemara says that our smicha is a different type of smicha that's known as netilas rishus. It's the smicha of having permission to teach Torah and to explain Torah and to paskin Torah, that it has been determined by those who gave you the smicha that you have the requisite clarity and knowledge to be able to do it properly. Nonetheless, we still call it smicha, and we still call the position rabbi. And the reason for that is, you look at the Ramah, the Tshuvas of Ramah, you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, they say because fundamentally we are preserving the basic nature and character of the original smicha. Otherwise, we wouldn't call it smicha, we wouldn't call it rabbi. We would call it something else. We would call the person Chacham so-and-so. We wouldn't use this position of a rabbi. We wouldn't use the framework of smicha to convey this stature if it was not intended to preserve the essential form of the original smicha. Therefore, somebody who is excluded from serving as a dayan, because the halakha is they can't serve as a dayan, is ipso facto automatically excluded from the genuine universe of smicha. If we're giving real smicha, a real orthodox smicha in our community, so it does not make any sense, given that the smicha is modeled after the original smicha. Like Tosa says at the end of Gittin, on Daf Peches Amud Beis, that the rabbis have authority nowadays to paskin cases based on shlichusayo de kamaika of dinan. We're still considered to be the shluchim, we're still considered to be the agents on some level, we're still considered to be carrying the same torch, we're the continuation, we're the successors of the original musmachim. So therefore, the conversation about women serving in this capacity, even leaving aside the svara considerations, and there are significant svara considerations, but you're the actual rav of a community, but even leaving that aside, you spoke about being an assistant rabbi. Any kind of rabbinical position would automatically be off limits on this basis. On the other hand, if we can get past what would be that red herring discussion regarding smicha, because that's really a non-starter, and you start talking about other positions, community scholars, scholars in residence, even the Yoratz Sod Halacha position I was mentioning, or other types of positions that you might fashion within different communities, so then the analysis becomes more nuanced, and it becomes more subtle, and it becomes on some level much more difficult to navigate, and you have to take into account these Sarara considerations. You have to take into account Sneer's considerations. Is it something that's furthering Sneer's? Is it a type of position that's focused upon Taras and Mishpach, on the Kedusha of the family? Is it a position where the woman is not compromising principles of Sneer's in terms of her interactions with the men in the community? And you also have to bear in mind the idea of Mesorah, the idea that when we have a strong, long-lasting traditions, like the Netziv writes, that it says in one place, Lo'olam yaseh godom v'Torah mitzvah safilu shlo lishma shemitok shlo lishma balishma. Another place the Gemara says that if you osek b'Torah shlo lishma, nasis lo sam amabis. It becomes like a poison. It becomes a tonic of death. So which is it? Is it that Shelo Lishma leads to good things, or that Shelo Lishma is considered to be like rat poison? So the Nitziv explains that if you're talking about Chidushim, you're talking about coming up with new innovations, if you're going to do it Shelo Lishma, if for whatever reason the motivation is some type of form of a feminism which is not predicated upon advancing the ideals of the Torah, so then that could be like a Sama Mavis. So that also has to be appropriately taken into the consideration when evaluating these types of questions as well. Okay, we'll take a break for a couple of minutes for questions. Yes?
On the airport.
Okay, go ahead.
So we recognize that Smicha today is not, you know, through the Smicha of yesteryear. But Rabbi was saying the Pesach of Binyan gives it a status that it's modeled after it. Meaning, what, in what way is it technically like the Smicha?
It's modeled after, like the Aruch HaShulchan writes. So there's the question, do you give smicha for a limited sphere of a person's expertise? Like, do you give smicha just for gittin, even if a person doesn't have smicha, say, for all of the traditional areas of rabbinic knowledge? So this was a machlokis, in which there were achronim who said different ways, and the Aruch HaShulchan ultimately comes out with the conclusion that you shouldn't give smicha in individualized areas, other than, you know, the broad areas that I discussed in the Gemara. The Gemara talks about Yorah, Yadin, Yadin. You know, those already have precedent in the Gemara, so you shouldn't give it in more circumscribed areas, because he says that it's important that the smicha be modeled after the original smicha. The original smicha, you didn't give a partial smicha. So we find that, for example, in the Aruch HaShulchan. Okay? Yes?
In terms of having a woman be there to answer questions about the house on the shlacha, even if the shlalot didn't feel uncomfortable, wouldn't it still be, I guess, wouldn't the best way to advance the Davut Tznias to, even from the man's point of view, from the answer's point of view, to have a woman ask a woman versus having a woman ask a man? Does that make sense? Meaning, from a man's point of view, it's probably not the most sensitive thing to discuss.
These are good questions. At the same time, the Gemara says that David HaMelech, while he was running an entire nation, was up to his knees in blood because the woman would bring him all of their shilas when it came to their sacks and their placentas. So we do find that there's a precedent for it. Sometimes we don't even understand that precedent, but somehow the Gemara is conveying a message when it came to this particular area of Misorah, of even Kedushas Yisrael, of dealing with these Shilohs, the questions would be posed to men. So I asked Rav Aaron Lichtenstein this question. It was the summer before he was Nifter. I went to visit Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. I was told afterwards it was the last, like, real substantive conversation he was able to have with a non-family member in which he was able to give Eitzah. So I feel myself very, very privileged. So I remember the conversation. The witnesses who were there during the conversation. It was just taking, you know, my word for it. And I asked him, what about this question of your Esad Halacha is something that he viewed as what could be a very positive development, certainly there in Eretz Yisrael. I said, what about this question of paskening amaros? The Chidah says that women can pasken if you have a very, very learned woman. You know, Rav Shechter's, you know, major, you know, Rav Shechter's argument is that even a man shouldn't pasken unless he knows Kol HaTorah Kula. So you're only a specialist in this area. So you shouldn't pasken unless you know Kol HaTorah Kula. That's true of men as well. We have to have everyone have the requisite humility. But I asked him just as a matter of principle this question. And Rav Lichtenstein's answer to me, Rav Lichtenstein was never one to just give a yes or no answer. It's important to clarify. But Rav Lichtenstein said, I know the Yoreh Tzot Halacha. I know the women who have become Yoreh Tzot Halacha here in Eretz Yisrael. And it's inconceivable to me that they would pasken on a mara without showing the mara to a rav. That's what Rav Lichtenstein said to me. And I took that answer to mean that Rav Lichtenstein, thinking about the totality of Torah, because you need a gadol to really wrestle with these questions, because it's a good question. You need a gadol to wrestle with it and to think, what do you do with the sugya regarding David HaMelech? And, you know, what do you do with your question? Oh, doesn't it help to preserve tznias if the man could stay out of it altogether? But Avraham felt no, a rav should be involved. That it shouldn't be something that should be passed, even by a woman who's very, very learned in this area. We have a misora, and this is part of the need to show up a rav yoreh, like the Sam Sofer says, the need that the rav, after he received, you know, smichas of yor, yor, and yadin, yadin, he would still consult when he had hard questions with everybody else. That you have to be able to consult with the Gedolei Hador regarding the parameters of where you would take a position like this. And that's a very, very important part of the exercise. You can't presume to know all of the answers. Now, the bottom line is that we have to think about these questions in terms of these board categories, like I mentioned. We also have to think about these questions in terms of what types of positions within the parameters that we've described and with appropriate consultation are going to enhance Shmir Samitzos, are going to enhance Yerushalayim, and are going to enhance really an atmosphere of tznius in our community rather than undermining it. This is, you know, the idea of what are the parameters of the Svara Shel Sara. We speak about Ava Megayeres HaNoshim, Svara Megayeres HaNoshim. We have to figure out how do we circumscribe and how do we appropriately define the Svara. Just like we define and circumscribe Svara when it comes to men. It's not something that we embrace wholeheartedly. It's something that we embrace with reluctance. So this is, we have to figure out what are the needs of the community in this regard within the parameters of halacha. We can look at a couple of models. In this regard, you look within your materials, you'll see that the Chachamim, throughout the generations, wrestled with a number of different innovations. They wrestled with the question of a woman saying Kaddish. The Chavos Yair asked the question hundreds of years ago in Germany. If you have a man who didn't leave any sons and he left instructions for a daughter to say Kaddish, and she wouldn't even say it in shul, it would be only in the home after sessions of Torah learning. Is this something which is appropriate? And the Chavos Yair says he doesn't see any halachic impediment. There's no sugya of Kaddish in the Gemara altogether, the same way that it comes from a Zohar that says it's a zechus. If a son says Kaddish, so it could be a zechus if a daughter says Kaddish. But he says, I worry, however, that I'm going to be machlish min hagi Yisrael. I worry that if we allow this innovation, it's going to lead to a slippery slope, that somehow there won't be as much respect for the age-old, time-honored traditions that we have of how we conduct rituals in our community. So he was much more circumspect. And you had a discussion going on for centuries among different Chachamim. Well, maybe it's okay if the man didn't leave sons and he left daughters, and it's not in the shul, and it's only in the home. And it went back and forth. And some saying, no, you can't really have it because Kaddish is a Dorosh HaBikdusha and requires a minyan. It can only be done by men. You had an essay by Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, where he published in the Hapardes Journal, I think in the 1950s, where he spoke about this issue. And he says, look, what does it mean to provide a zechus for the neshama of one's parent? That's if a person is acting in a fashion of tznius and the shomeres mitzvos, and she's a hashir shemayim. So if you have a woman who satisfies all of these criteria, she's not looking to say kaddish, like to push the envelope with respect to a woman's roles in Judaism or changing the halacha, but this is, she comports herself in a way that brings zechus to the neshama anyway, efshar shein kepeda. So it's afshar that it's not something that we have to be concerned about. If she says Kaddish in the women's section at the same time that the men say Kaddish in the men's section, she'll say for the women while the men are saying for the men, whatever that means. And after he said the words Efshar She'en Kepedah, so obviously it became Het Gama. That's what happens when you have a God of Yisrael who says Efshar She'en Kepedah. And there were those, like I have in the materials here an article by Rosh Shlomo Woman. He quotes his Rebbe, Rebbe Eliezer Silver, who were not at all happy about this ruling of Henkin. They felt that, number one, that it opened up the floodgates for innovations that would not be up the halacha, and they felt also that it was hard to justify within the parameters of a Dover Shebikdusha. Well, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik interestingly wrote that once this is something which could be provided with a halachic justification, starting with the Chavos Yair, and going on to Rav Henkin and so forth. So if Aaron said, once something really is permissible, and it's something which is being encouraged for women to be able to exercise and to be able to fulfill their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu so that they will really feel proud of their tradition and more likely to transmit it. So he said, then you really have an obligation not to stop the women from saying Kaddish if they want to say Kaddish, because then they might leave the Orthodox synagogue altogether, and that's a much more of a concern than the concerns that you would have of following a psak from a reputable Gadol B'Yisrael, and where there is a halakhic basis to allow for this practice of a woman saying Kaddish in the women's section while a man says it in the men's section. So you find this balancing act that the Rabbanim have been conducting with respect to a plethora of different issues. You have this with respect to the bat mitzvah ceremony, where Rav Moshe was very against. He said, if I had the ability, I would abolish bar mitzvah celebrations. Because bar mitzvah celebrations were often like, who knows, in disco halls. There was a certain point in time in which they were very non-edifying here in America in terms of the observance of the people who are having bar mitzvah celebrations. And yet, you have this Sridi Yesh, who wrote a tshuva saying that at least in the context of his community, where it was important for the women to feel really good once they reached the age of bat mitzvah, once they became a woman, when they became obligated, they became eligible to really fulfill their mandate of transmitting the Torah tradition, it was important to fortify and reinforce them. So he said that he was in favor of bat mitzvah ceremonies. He said, not in a shul. It shouldn't, like, we're mimicking the non-Orthodox and their ways and their traditions and other innovations that they make. You do it in a fashion where it's only in the social hall and not in the shul, and there are ways of circumscribing it. And you mentioned the Sephardim, and Rabbi Yosef said, we never had a problem with the Sephardic tradition. We always celebrated bat mitzvah, so there's no slippery slope to worry about. Very much, it's a community-based consideration, and it's one that has to be navigated very, very carefully and very gingerly by the Rabbanim. But you have to have a sense of the non-negotiables as well. The Bach says, Kavod HaTzibor is a non-negotiable. The notion of Ish Lo Tikra B'Torah M'Bnei Kavod HaTzibor, as it says in the Gemara Megillah and Daf Chav Gimel, the Bach says you can't waive Kavod HaTzibor. You have to know what are the boundaries, the objective boundaries of Tznius that have been placed upon us by the Torah. That's why partnership minyanim doesn't make sense within our tradition, because that's an objective boundary of Tznius in terms of the women reading from the Torah. That's a coveted tziba that the Gemara defines. We have to, like the OU panel said, at a certain point surrender ourselves to the will of the Almighty, but do so with a sense of joy that we're happy that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has delineated very clear parameters when it comes to certain boundaries, so we know the area that we are navigating and we know the points in which we can not go beyond. Ultimately, we have to remember as well, the B'Zchus Nashim Tzidkaniyos Nigalu Avosinim Mitzrayim, it was in the S'chus of the righteous women that our forefathers were redeemed from Egypt, like the Benos Tzlovchot, that are described in the Gemara Baba Basra Daf Kuf Yates as Chachmonios, because the Gemara says they were Chachmonios because had they been sons, they wouldn't have asked. So Chachmah in Torah is governed by a concern about upholding Torah principles. And that's why, in addition to our having this conversation, it's also extremely important in order for us to reach the right results that we have to remember to always consult as well with our Noshim Tzidkaniyos.
Okay, 30 seconds.